It's Central Time. I'm Rob Parrott. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Social media use was on the rise for years and years, but there are some signs that those trends are tapering off. And a lot of people are turning instead to a different way of connecting online with friends and family, group chats, and texts. Whether it's WhatsApp, Messenger, Discord, or just regular old cell phone text messages, people are turning toward this more direct form of group communication instead of relying on social media algorithms to mediate their interactions. Like any platform, group chats have their own set of social dynamics and etiquette that come with up and downsides. We're exploring the rise of group messaging, how we communicate over text with different social groups. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have some kind of group chat, maybe with family members, a particular group of friends? How do they work for you? Do you like them as a way to keep up with people? Or do all the messages start to become too much? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Catalina Toma is an associate professor of communication science at UW-Madison. She researches how people interact over communication technologies. Catalina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
I've been seeing articles about the rise of group chat and thought, well, I don't really do that. And then I thought, well, wait, I've got one with my, you know, immediate family, and one with my parents, one with my band, and one with my football buddies and things like that. It kind of snuck up on me. Is this a big trend that we're seeing out there, people turning toward group text as a mode of communication?
I think it is. I think we're seeing definitely an increase in this new form of communication. And it's really interesting to think about why we're seeing this migration, as you said, from social media platforms, social networking sites, to these more personalized, private forms of communication. And I have some theories about that. I'm happy to share. One, I think COVID played a big part in this, where opportunities for face-to-face contact were severely limited, and there was a need to talk to the people nearest and dearest to us, and these platforms provided that opportunity. But second, and I think a little bit more interestingly, is that people have kind of matured in their use of social networking sites, and they've realized that maybe not everybody is interested in seeing what they converse about in a mundane way with friends and family, right? Because that's what would happen when we would, you know, tag each other and post on each other's walls and comment and talk to each other in a public forum. You know, social networking sites are an interesting environment because they connect us with really large and diverse audiences. We call this context collapse, right? When we talk to people publicly on social media, we talk to groups of people who we would never talk to simultaneously. It could be your friends and your family and your romantic partner and your boss and your coworkers and a bunch of strangers and some people you met at a party. You would never talk to these people together simultaneously, but on social media you can. And that definitely has some cons. So it makes sense for people to move away from those more indiscriminate broadcasting types of communication to more personalized and private and targeted communications through group chat.
Yeah, it seems like so much of social media incentivizes you to go big, to have a wider reach, to expand your group of friends or followers or whatever the particular platform has, and get messages that lots of people see. That group chat, you know exactly how many people you're reaching, and you have no incentive to try to go beyond that.
Exactly. Social networking site companies, you know, Facebook, Twitter, X, Snapchat, so on and so forth, are trying to get people to publicize as much as possible, to engage, to share, to overshare, because that's what attracts attention. But from the user perspective, that's not always wise or beneficial. So users are opting increasingly for more privacy, and that's what we're seeing with group chats.
Is there something about the technology that's making group chat easier? I mean, there are different apps that are better at it, but I've also noticed there used to be Apple-Android divides where things functioned differently. Is it just a smoother, less friction-y technology now?
It is smoother. And I think, looking back, I think that was one of the big appeals of WhatsApp when it first started to get traction. It really facilitated group chats and, you know, it enabled you to give these groups names and use emojis to cutify the name and invite people and so on and so forth. And that was a real draw of the platform at the time that users enjoyed.
Can you talk about how we define social groups within these group chats? Again, on Facebook, say our social group is everybody who has friended us and whoever they share it with. Now it seems like we're defining things in a different way when we're selectively saying this goes to group A, this goes to group B.
Right. And I would say, very broadly speaking, there could be two types of groups. You know, the more permanent groups that you constantly talk to, and very typically people have a group for family members, people have a group for close friends or different groups of friends that they talk to on the regular. But there's also more temporary groups, like event-based groups. We're organizing this dinner with so-and-so, and we want to talk about the logistics, and we create a very temporary group for that, and that goes away. But what's really interesting to me is the more permanent groups that allow for the sense of connection and sharing in a really non-frictiony way, right? Like, because there's many members of the group, everybody can contribute a little bit. You can feel connected to the group without a deep expense of energy on anybody's side.
Talking to Catalina Toma with the UW-Madison Communication Science Department, looking at the rise of group texting, group chats as a way for people to communicate online instead of, in many cases, social media platforms. Is this you? Are you doing this? Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that chat going maybe with family members, a group of friends, or coworkers, or fill in the blank? What do you use it for? Is it ever too much? Do you ever look at your phone and say, what the heck's going on? Why do I have all these messages? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm seeing a lot of articles and comments out there, Catalina, about, yeah, it's getting overwhelming. People use these things in a different way. I'll give one example. In my band, we have a group. It's usually very practical. Is there practice tonight? Here's our latest band files, whatever. And then sometimes three of us get going chatting about something, and the fourth one hates that and doesn't want to see all those messages pop up. How do we negotiate that kind of etiquette, not just in my band, but in whatever group we happen to be in?
Yeah, that's really interesting conversations to be had. And I think people are aware of what's interesting to whom, but also the technology allows you to ignore messages pretty easily and without a lot of cost, right? So I don't know about your group member who's annoyed. It's probably me. I would probably just not read those messages. But if the annoyance is expressed, then you can, of course, take the conversation elsewhere. You can create a different group where everybody's interested. In my experience, and from what I know of research in the psychology of these technologies, people enjoy this sense of connection that doesn't require a lot of effort. Even if you might not read everything, getting those notifications feels good because you're part of a conversation. People think about you. You're included. And all of those are really important psychological signifiers for people that feel really great.
There is now a separate group for everyone but the guitarist. So it worked itself out. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rachel is with us in Eau Claire. Rachel, hi.
I wanted to comment about the differing media literacy that we have in the world and how many people fake identities and how there's often gatekeeping and less social interaction based on gatekeeping. I try to educate based on tics, Tourette's diagnosis, Tourette's syndrome, about what different aspects of it mean. People on TikTok came at me, attacked me. They found out where I went to university, and they reported me to the university, and I'm like, I try to educate people, but you're going to be mean. Let's go group chat.
Rachel, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Not a great signal there, but Rachel, talk about some of the risks of those much more public-facing sites, in this case, TikTok, versus having that group chat with people you're not as likely to be attacked by, say, total strangers on that personal group chat.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed Rachel's point and her emphasis on some of the more serious risks of posting on social media, right? It's not just oversharing and giving too much information to friends and family in a way that they could be annoyed with you, but very serious risks like identity theft and so on and so forth. So to mitigate those risks of social media, moving to more private channels of communication makes a lot of sense. And I really love that Rachel brought on the concept of social media literacy, which is something we're all working on, right? And it's not always super obvious on how to navigate these complicated spaces. which is why we have programs like this one.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for the call, Rachel. We are talking to UW-Madison Communication Science Professor Catalina Toma about group chats, group texts, how we communicate to our friends and family at the same time over text, maybe instead of social media, maybe replacing some of the ways we've used social media. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a group chat? Do you have lots and lots of group chats? Do you like them? What do you use them for? Practical stuff, fun stuff, a little bit of both? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Catalina Toma, Associate Professor of Communication Science at UW-Madison, who researches social interaction over digital platforms. We're talking about one of those platforms now, the rise in popularity of group chats and text groups as a form of communication among family, friends, coworkers, you name it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have group texts or group chats in your social group, your friends, your family? Do you like it? Does it get a little much? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Libby is with us in Mosinee. Libby, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, you know, I have several groups in WhatsApp, and we actually also connect on Facebook. And I've been living here in the U.S. since I was 18, and I'm 55 now. And I reconnected with my friends from elementary school. We have not seen each other for 45 years.
Wow.
And it started with my best friends, a group of three, and then we ended up adding 25 out of the 32. And I also have my group from middle school and my group from high school down in Panama while I'm here. And we communicate constantly, and there's like a zillion notifications, but whoever doesn't want it, they can turn it off. It's energizing. I really love it. My day's busy, because I teach. I just ignore it. And then I go to it during the weekend when I have time.
Libby,
so it's very convenient.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm glad you're able to reconnect with old friends back in, I think you said, Panama. And Catalina, international communication has been difficult and expensive for many years, and now it's almost free for people in Libby's situation. Could you talk about how this has changed how we communicate across not just state lines, but across international lines?
No, absolutely. This is a great point. And I think this is where WhatsApp really shone in the beginning, because it was a web-based application that anybody with an internet connection could use, as opposed to regular text messages that you'd have to be a subscriber for and pay for. So it allowed people across the world to communicate with one another and connect across geographical boundaries. And that's such a gift, and it contributes so much to people's well-being and ability to stay in touch. So I really appreciate that point. And Libby also talked about some features of online communication of these group texts that are really beneficial, such as they're kind of asynchronous in the sense that you don't have to respond right away. You don't have to engage right away in the same way that you would with a telephone call, right? You can take your time, you can engage at your convenience on the weekend or whatever works for you. And that could be really, really beneficial. In fact, this is why people prefer texting over, say, the telephone, kind of in a more general sense. And they've developed research identifies this interesting phenomenon of phone fears, right? When the phone rings, you're almost worried because it's probably something bad and it's probably something serious. That's when people feel like it's okay to intrude, to stop whatever you're doing so you can take the phone call. Whereas a group chat or any text for that matter, you can engage with at your convenience. And that's really great.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Al joins us next in Green Bay. Al, hi.
Hey, thanks for putting me on. So the setup for this is I'm a professional driver. Every time the Tampa Bay Buccaneers come to Green Bay, they hire our firm to move their owners around. There's five owners, their brothers and sisters, come from different locations. So we have one driver assigned to each one of these owners. On the Sunday morning of the game, the security guy sits down with us and he takes every one group text.
Oh, we're losing.
It doesn't matter what color your phone, It doesn't matter what color your phone is. Doesn't matter. You don't need an app. You just need the ability to text, right? So then I text when I depart for the airport. I text when I've got my passenger on. I text when I got my passenger off. The security guy stays in one place, and he immediately knows at any given time where any of the five people are that he's worried about.
Interesting. Al, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. You're cutting in and out there a little bit. Next time you see him, say maybe they should sell Manchester United, by the way. But this is a very practical use, a one-off use. We've got this logistical situation, and we're using this group chat to manage it, Catalina.
Absolutely. We call these acts micro-coordination, right? Texting really allows you to coordinate with multiple people almost in real time if everybody's connected simultaneously and knows that they're important. It's important to converse in real time. And you can do those with many people and with much less effort than on a phone call. And that's a really valuable aspect of texting.
Al, thanks a lot for that call. We are talking about the rise of group text, group chats as a way to communicate with friends, family, fellow drivers, as it turns out in this case. Still time for you to join in with your experience, for good or ill, with group texting, group chats at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, texting has been around for a long time. Usually it was a two-way. It could be I text you, you text me back, that sort of thing. What are you watching for as our use of group chats evolves and group texting evolves?
Well, it's interesting to think about group size. You know, what is a good group size for having those conversations and how group size and composition will affect what it is that people talk about. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to look at psychological effects. I mean, we predict that people enjoy these group communication because more people are using them. But it's important to study why they enjoy it, you know, what psychological benefits of connection people get through it, but also the bad side, like what are some troublesome conversations that could be had? What are some blind spots that people could be having and maybe oversharing depending on the composition and the size of the group?
And then the question of why am I not in this group?
Right. So a lot of technologies make exclusion a little invisible. Like if you're not part of the group, you don't know what's going on. So it doesn't hurt in the same way as seeing people in the office in that corner talking amongst themselves without you. So being excluded is a little bit less obvious. But when it does become obvious, it's as painful as any other exclusion.
And our caller earlier, Libby, mentioned, you know, some of these group chats are 20-some people. That seems like a lot to manage.
That is a lot to manage. And this is what I hear anecdotally from my students, too. When groups become too large, they become dysfunctional, as in there's not a suitable conversation for everybody. So we have to move away from those groups and maybe create new ones.
Let's bring on another caller. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. So as it pertains to social media and the public realm, I currently work with a company who employs another company to pre-screen all potential applicants by not just doing a background check, but they check all of their social media, anything that you would post publicly, Facebook or X or what have you, and anything that's maybe radical or extreme could certainly cost somebody the ability to gain employment. So,
interesting.
You know,
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. A lot of that out there, barring a subpoena, as some famous crypto entrepreneurs have discovered, mostly that kind of our texts or group texts aren't going to come up in that kind of screening process, I would assume. Catalina.
They are not. They are not. And that's a real advantage. I mean, we've all heard the stories of employers and significant others like scrutinizing stuff that's being posted publicly in a way that was never intended by the poster. And that could have really serious repercussions. And this, you know, privacy risk is one of the reasons people move away to more private channels of communication.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Time for another caller. Bonnie is with us in Lake Geneva. Bonnie, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your group text story?
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Bonnie, what did you want to tell us about?
Well, I have a lot of siblings, and we have a group chat called the Cool Cats, Cool Cats 2, and we're very busy on it, but it gets crazy during Green Bay Packers games.
Awesome, Bonnie. Thanks. I have a group of friends around the country now, and the only time pretty much we activate the group text is during a Packer game, maybe the Super Bowl. It's a nice way for occasional communication, Catalina.
Absolutely. I used to have a group chat where we would Wordle. Do you remember Wordle
when
it first came up? And we would share the Wordles every morning, and then we got tired of it after a while. But it was one of those situational group chats that gives you some enjoyment about sharing something you have in common.
Thanks a lot for that. Before we run out of time, I want to talk about this as an intergenerational thing. Because, like, okay, maybe adults do Facebook, kids do Insta or whatever they're doing now. My kids will be on the group chats. My parents will be on the group chats. It seems to be a place where people of different ages can come together.
I'm so glad that you brought that up. I think that's really interesting. And one of the sticky points that this brings forth is the issue of literacy, right? Different generations might have different comfort levels with the group chats. And that's why, even though it's possible to have group chats on platforms like Facebook or Snapchat, they might not be as accessible intergenerationally as something really, really simple, like just texting or just WhatsApp. We got to keep those considerations in mind.
All right. Just a personal question. How many group chats do you reckon you have going at any given time?
I have, maybe four or five.
Okay.
I guess not a ton, but I enjoy all of them. Even if they're talking about stuff that doesn't pertain to me directly, it's really nice to be included in the conversation, be a fly on the wall. I enjoy them a lot.
Catalina, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Catalina Toma is an associate professor of communication science at UW-Madison. She's with us today to talk about group chats and group texting and why more and more of us are communicating with friends, family, and others over shared text messages, maybe instead of social media platforms. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Have you ever sat down one evening and thought to yourself, that was a day? If you wrote about that day, could its events, its trials, tribulations, highs, lows, mysteries, revelations, fill an entire book? Our next guest has made an impressive literary career of filling books, big ones, with storytelling about a world of his own creation, told from the perspective of a span of individual days. The same is true from his newest book, a standalone story that takes place in one day in his fictional world. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss, a reader of fantasy fiction yourself? Have you ever worked to create your own fantasy world for a role-playing game, for your own writing? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Wisconsin's own Patrick Rothfuss is the author of the King Killer Chronicle fantasy series. It kicked off with The Name of the Wind. His new book is called The Narrow Road Between Desires, set in the fictional world where his other novels take place. Fun fact, he was a guest on the pilot version of a radio show that eventually became this show. Pat, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, first off, I didn't know that. I didn't know that I was I was an early adopter. But also, that was the best, nicest lead-in I have heard in a mortal age. I am so tickled, and I'm really kind of blushy right now.
Oh, stop.
it's true. I never actually realized that. Yeah, I guess I do frame things in terms of days, which sounds silly now that I kind of admit that that wasn't intentional.
Wow. And I'll credit to our producer, Tim Peterson. I've read your books, but I didn't really until I thought back. It's like, yeah, the novels were told. Yeah. Anyway, a lot of people in Wisconsin familiar with your work. For those who aren't, can you tell us a bit about the world that The Name of the Wind and the new book, The Narrow Road Between Desires, is set in?
That is a dangerous one, and I'll try to do it briefly.
How much time do we have? Yeah,
exactly. Everyone out there just heard me say briefly and they're rolling their eyes. Fantasy, if you look at Tolkien, he wrote what is referred to as secondary world fantasy. It happens somewhere else. There's a lot of modern fantasy is written in this world, but different, or this world, but there's secrets. When I sat down to start this whole project, gosh, 20 years ago, I knew I wanted to tell a story in another world, but the thing that I wanted to avoid is something I've seen in so many of the books that I loved, but it broke my heart. At the end of The Lord of the Rings, Middle Earth is kind of done. The story exhausts the world. There can't ever be follow-ups because, like, the elves are leaving, and the story is so big that there's no room for more things to happen after it in the world without seeming anticlimactic. So when I started writing this story, I'm like, I want to tell a smaller story about a man's life. You know, what's, like, I've heard it referred to as the backstage pass to the myth of the hero. But after I always thought when I'm done telling this person's story, there's more world, more places, more people. So that's my world. It is a fun place to explore, but hopefully big enough. I always hoped for multiple stories. That's not very descriptive at all.
That's okay. But I actually want to take it to this new book, The Narrow Road Between Desires. You've actually done exactly what you just talked about in this and a previous book, taken one character, a secondary character from the main arc, and said, in effect, what does a day in their life look like? And it's a very different feel and a very different voice, but it allows you to explore another part of that world you created.
And, you know, it was something I stumbled into with Slow Regard, the book that should never have been written and I never thought would be published, the book where nothing happens, but that I love it anyway. And, you know, this one, at least I could think, well, people do want to show up for effectively, you know, you get to see a secondary character live their own life. There's a term for that sort of episode in a TV show, but I don't know it because I don't do TV shows.
I wanted to talk about the challenge of writing fantasy, and I'm always impressed with this fantasy and some science fiction where, as you said, it's set not in our world, where in addition to telling a story, you have to answer a lot of questions about how that world works, but also, I mean, and some old science fiction is, here's an encyclopedia chapter for the first chapter, so you know where we are. The challenge of, like, working all that world building in while still, you know, advancing a plot.
It is the persistent issue, and it's one, you know, we all love Granddaddy Tolkien. We're in his shadow. And his shadow is long. And I love The Lord of the Rings. Read it every year as a kid. It's got fingerprints all over my heart. But good Lord, that book starts slow, right? And he's like, hey, there's a place. And they have birthday parties. And they give gifts. And they're called Mathomes. And there's a museum. And so this guy is going to have a birthday. And here's what that birthday is like. And you're like, Tolkien, it's been 50 pages. What's going on here? And so what it's talked about in this day and age is you make this world because you have to make a world to tell a story in it. And then you're kind of proud of it and you want to show it off and you have to show it off. But, you know, the rookie mistake is to, again, follow a little too closely in Tolkien's footsteps and you show everything off and you're excited because your baby is very smart and pretty and you really want to talk about the cool religion you made or the magic you have. And it's called the info dump. In my experience, the problem isn't making a cool world. The problem is making it and then shutting up about it and doing a story instead. And I'm afflicted with it as much as anyone because I do a wild amount of world building.
Talking to Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss, author of the series that starts with The Name of the Wind. A new book set in that world is just out, The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your questions, your experiences reading fantasy literature, and a question I'm about to ask Patrick is, what kind of stuff do you like to read to your kids? Do you have fond memories of having things read to you by your parents growing up? Join in at 800-642-1234. Pat, you were mentioning your reading of The Lord of the Rings as a kid. I know you've talked online and elsewhere about what you like to read to your own kids. What is on your hit list? What kind of things do you look for to read to kids?
I do. You know, for a long time, for those of you out there that know what Goodreads is, I used to review a lot of books there. And then as I started to read more to my boys and look more at kids' books, I shifted almost entirely to sharing my many, many opinions about children's literature, because good Lord, if you're a careful parent who wants to limit a child's exposure to some really toxic cultural stuff, there's a lot to look out for in some of these classic books. But yeah, I never knew that Little House on the Prairie was real or a book until I already had kids. So I read all of them to the boys, editing on the fly to avoid, there are some racist and sexist things in there, but still they're fabulous. They're more fantastic than a lot of fantasy I've read. These days, though, my boys are 9 and 14, and there's very little, like, in terms of, age range that I wouldn't lay on them, think of who their daddy is, right? So, I've read The Hobbit to them multiple times. They could practically sing along with the opening. Right now I'm rereading The Last Unicorn to them, one of my all-time favorite books. I read this book to them, only because on a lark, I was reading, Ursula K. Le Guin's foundational, Wizard of Earthsea, which I love and they love, but it was not meant to be read out loud, and it was hard. And if you're doing it before bed, you don't want an extra job. And I got maybe I could read them a little bit of Slow Regard, which I remembered being easy to read out loud because I did the audiobook. And I'm like, and I did it. And I immediately got self-conscious. And I said, you know what, boys, this was silly. I'm not going to read you my own. And they're like, please, please, please. And I read it. And they loved this story about nothing. They were so into it. And so I bounced this book off of them as well. And they helped me catch a few mistakes and they helped me work on the illustrations. So I read to them all the time. Not as much as I wish I would, but still an awful lot. Yeah.
We're talking to Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss about some of his storytelling craft, including speculative fiction and world building, and his new book. It's called The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Have you already picked up the new book? Are you a writer yourself? Do you need maybe some inspiration for your own creativity? And do you have favorite things to read to kids? Or do you have a favorite memory of being read to as a kid? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss is with us talking about the craft of storytelling in his new book set in his fictional world. It's called The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Green Bay. John, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to share a quick story of my aunt reading Shel Silverstein poems to us, my sister and I, and how much we just enjoyed that experience, how his words brought those poems to our imagination and Yeah, another. I forgot the titles. It's Another Light in the Attic, something like that. Perhaps the author knows.
A Light in the Attic. Yeah.
And John, I got to ask before I let you go. Have you passed those on to a new generation, or do you plan to?
Yes, we've kept them, and I read them to my kids. But now my kids are 19, 21, 23. So we'll see. They'll be held on to for another generation.
My kids are that age. They don't let me read to them anymore either. But I had a great aunt who read Shel Silverstein to us as a kid. It's the poems that aunts read to kids, apparently, Pat.
Oh, Shel Silverstein just gave me like a tingle of joy. The boys would read some of that to each other. Mm. I also stumbled onto videos of Shel Silverstein reading his own stuff, which was wild. Like, it was not what I expected because he was an intense man.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Pat, in the new book, I get a little bit of a fairy tale feel to it, for a couple of reasons, I think. Do you look to the worlds of fairy tales and folklore for some of your inspiration?
Absolutely. And for this one in particular, I kind of put my foot in it because I'm like, oh, you know, I actually studied fairy tales. I used to collect fairy tales. I'm like, back in my arrogant youth, I'm like, I just want to read all of the classic fairy tales, get them under my belt. You can't. There's so many, and from all different cultures. However, when I'm like, I'll draw on some of those elements. And, you know, if I'm trying to fit some of those things into my world is not the world of, you know, medieval Europe, mm-hmm. or where the Grimm brothers were, or, you know, a lot of these, you know, this different mindset. So the cultural things don't fit together, but also trying to bring in and sort of be mindful of a different sort of morality. Because these fairy tales were moral. Bruno Bettelheim wrote a great book. It's one of the few books written about fairy tales seriously, and it's called The Witch Must Die. Because people think, oh, these were never meant for children. The thing is, yeah, they weren't meant just for children. Kids love them, and they don't mind terrible things in stories so long as the people who do terrible things are punished. And that sort of, it's reassuring because you're like, oh, there might be bad people, but they're going to get theirs. And like, and that is a more, I'm not saying it's the best morality, but there's a moral compass in there. And like the evil stepmother in Sleeping Beauty, at the end, she's safe. She's back. She's getting married. And at the wedding, they heat up a pair of iron shoes by the fire, make her wear them and dance until she dies. So like, that's old Testament morality, mm-hmm. there. But that doesn't really, you know, fit in the world I created. And it's not necessarily the morality that I want to spread in my own fiction. So, I mean, a little taste of that is fine, but I don't want that to be the end all be all. So, trying to be socially responsible with what I'm sharing with the world, it's a little tricky because the old folk tales, they were dark, and fairies weren't really interested in important stuff like consent. And so I had some work to do there. Yeah.
Let's go back to our callers. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I just want to tell Patrick how much I enjoy his writing. I picked up The Name of the Wind. I don't know why I picked it, you know, but I loved it so much. I shared it with my whole family. And I just finished reading The Slow Regard again because I liked that so much. I saw it at the library. And now the mystery to me just called and said, your new book is in. Could I come and get it? So that's what I'm doing.
Barbara. Oh, who gave you a call?
The Murder to Me bookstore, I think she was referring to.
Oh, I love them. Yeah.
Barbara, thanks a lot for that call. Patrick, you're at a point where you've got lots of fans out there. What does it feel like just to have people out there looking forward to something, as Barbara did clearly, to picking up that book at the bookstore today?
You know, the proper answer is sort of the chirpy Hollywood interview answer, which is to say, oh, it's so great. And it is. I'm not saying that's not a true answer, but the really true answer is it's been like almost a decade since I published a book, and I've really felt bad about that. And I've beaten myself up about it. And there's books I've wanted to write, and there's books that people want to read from me. And then I do this book, and I know it's not the book some people want or wish for. And so it's not healthy, but I will admit, like, somebody asked me this exact question. Hey, you're getting a book out. How does it feel? Pretty good. And I'm like, actually, I have a sense of dread.
Oh, no.
Because I'm worried people will just be upset. It's not what they want. But hearing from people like that, I remember, like, you don't do things for the people that are going to be angry at you. Like, that shouldn't be my deciding thing. It's been so nice to hear it again and again as I put the book out. Some people are salty. It's not what they wanted, or it's been too long for them. But there's so many people who are kind and thoughtful, and they understand that life gets in the way. And it does me a world of good to hear that people still think of me fondly, honestly. Yeah.
Barbara, thanks a lot for the call. I think I said murder to me, mystery to me bookstore. Talking to Patrick Rothfuss, author of the King Killer Chronicle fantasy series. His latest book is called The Narrow Road Between Desires. It's been a while since we talked, Patrick, but I dimly recall that you really liked recommending books and sharing the stuff you're loving reading with other humans. You got any suggestions for us these days?
You know, when you're promoting a book, you know what your PR people hate is when you talk about another book that's coming out right now. But man, I'll do it every time. If you haven't read Murderbot, the Murderbot Diaries, I think I love it as much as I've loved anything that I've read that I've picked up new in these last 5 years. And you might think, what, Murderbot? I read a lot. And I don't know if I have loved anything as much as I've loved that. I've read it multiple, multiple times. The audiobook is stunning by Kevin R. Free. It's by Martha Wells. And the newest one, Me and My Boys, honestly, I've been kind of excited and kind of dreading my own book release. The book release we've really been looking forward to in this household with untrammeled joy is Martha Wells' new Murderbot. Start at the beginning, though, and trust me, it's gorgeous. I've never empathized with a character as much as I've empathized with Murderbot.
All right. We'll apologize to your PR people, Patrick.
No, I love it. Thank you for giving me the chance, because I'll talk about Murderbot all day. I would list 100 books, but I know that I shouldn't mention a book that's coming out literally right now, but absolutely pick that one up. Then you can try mine.
And then go ahead. Yeah. Oh, well, actually, I just want to ask briefly in our last half a minute or so, Patrick, you've taught creative writing, including at your alma mater, UW Stevens Point, over the years. Quick bit of inspiration for somebody who wants to write for, you know, maybe they're going to publish a book, maybe it's just for fun, a quick bit of inspiration for them.
I'll say this. There's no right way to do it. And anyone who says this is the way, take their advice with a grain of salt. Instead, if you want to make a world, don't feel like you got to do what Tolkien did. He was a linguist, so he did languages. He was a historian, so he based it on the Eddas. If you love stamp collecting and butterflies, and that's what you're into, make a world that centers around that, and I will be there for your weird Lepidoptera fantasy novel, man.
Pat, we'll leave it there. Good to talk to you again.
So good to talk to you.
That's Wisconsin-born and raised Patrick Rothfuss, author of the King Killer Chronicle fantasy series, which kicked off with The Name of the Wind. We talked to him about his latest book called The Narrow Road Between Desires and many other things as well. If you have a favorite book that you like reading to kids, email ideas@WPR.org. We can share it on a future program.